Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. In that connection, it is always a delight to have an opportunity to enjoy the benefit of the intelligence, both in the figurative sense and certainly the corporate memory and experience of a distinguished former senior special agent in the Immigration and Naturalization Services. He is Michael Cutler. You can find him on his own radio program, the Michael Cutler Hour, on Blog Talk Radio. And often you will find his writings at places like Front Page Magazine, but we're thrilled to say we feature him from time to time here as well. Michael, welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Great to have you with us.
Always good to join you, Frank. Thank you so much for covering these important topics.
Well, thank you so much for helping us do so. You have been worrying for some time about the phenomenon of so-called sleeper agents or sleeper cells. Congressman Peter King had a hearing in the Homeland Security Committee recently about that, and I'm interested in both your takeaway from the latest hearing and more broadly, what you believe is the degree to which this country has been penetrated by sufficient numbers of hostile actors that could, under the right set of circumstances, pose a real threat to the Homeland Security.
Well, that's an excellent question, and you're right. It does concern me greatly. And what frustrates me the most, you know, I've testified before. I think we're now up to 17 hearings before both House and Senate subcommittees and committees. And frequently, I've been raising the issue of sleeper agents, and I'm not the only one to do so. When Robert Mueller was the head of the FBI, he went before Congress numerous times and voiced his concerns. And if you look back to the 93 terror bombing at the World Trade Center, if you look at 9/11, if you look at the Tsarnaevs, if you look, they attacked, of course, the Boston Marathon. These were people who had set up shop in America, went about their day-to-day lives, and then ultimately carried out terrorist attacks. So, you know, we hear the media and we hear the open borders anarchists. There's no other way to describe those folks. Say, well, if someone doesn't have a criminal history, why would you arrest them? You would arrest them because you don't know why they're really here. You know, Mohammed Atta, the ringleader of 9/11, was stopped for speeding a short time before the attacks of 9/11. Now imagine that. So the police encounter him and they let him go. Unwittingly, they could have prevented 9/11 if they had called immigration. If I remember correctly, he had violated the terms of his admission. We are loaded with millions of people who have violated their status in the United States, not just people running the Mexican border. We lost more casualties, or we suffered more casualties to just 19 men barely out of their teens on 9/11, as compared with how many people were killed on December 7th, 1941, at the hands of the entire Japanese fleet. That's the difference that people need to understand. You don't need thousands and thousands of terrorists. You just need to have a few who know what they're doing and have a game plan that they can put into action, and the devastation can be unbelievable.
And that's with weapons of mass destruction in the form of jet airliners that were hijacked and flown into buildings. But there are others that are even more deadly that are presumably also making their way into their hands. You mentioned running the border very quickly, Michael Cutler. The porousness of the border is, of course, something you have been worrying and warning about for a long time, including, I think, last month in Front Page Magazine about jihadis and drug cartels at and, well, frankly, coming across our border. Just very quickly, your thoughts on the latest on that and the need for a wall in parts, at least.
Well, that's right. We're being overwhelmed. They're swarming. And by the way, if you look at the level of violence, 29,000 people killed in Mexico last year, roughly 21% of Mexico's GDP lost to the damage done by the extreme violence in Mexico right on the other side of the border. So we don't know who's coming into the country. We do know there are terror training camps in Brazil, We know that Iran flies their shock troops routinely into Venezuela. How in the world do you protect a nation when you have no control over who you're letting into your country? As homeowners, we lock our doors at night and we look through the peephole before we open the door to a stranger. All I'm recommending is that we as a country follow the same procedure and the same concept, because the risks are so profound.
Yeah. Speaking of which, you mentioned massing at the border. We, of course, have had the spectacle of this caravan recently. Michael Cutler, what's your advice to the president as to what to do with these people? They're now appealing for amnesty. I gather at least some of them are entitled to it. Will they get it? And will that simply be a magnet for vastly larger numbers of them to do pretty much the same thing?
Well, I share your concern. They're looking for political asylum. And this is what's so ironic. And, you know, I'm Jewish. My family was decimated in the Holocaust. I'm sympathetic to the notion of political asylum. But this isn't political asylum. Perhaps it's economic asylum. They're not claiming that they face persecution because of race, religion, ethnicity, or political viewpoint. That's traditionally what political asylum is about. They're claiming there's extreme violence in their home countries. And because so many are coming across the border, as we've seen with the terrorists entering Europe with those refugee groups, we have the potential for terrorists and gang members coming across this way. And in fact, Bob Goodlatte, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, had a hearing a couple of hearings, focusing on how members of the Mexican cartels had successfully acquired political asylum in the United States, either fleeing violence against them or to operate within our borders under the sanction of our laws. Look, we have to make certain that our immigration laws, first and foremost, put U.S. national security, U.S. public safety, and the livelihood of American workers ahead of all other considerations. What the president is doing, assigning more prosecutors and judges to that part of the country, I agree, along the border. But interior enforcement is the key. Because one way or the other, the bad actors get to the United States, whether it's violating a visa, stowing away on a ship, or running our northern or southern borders. At the end of the day, they're within the interior. We've never had enough immigration agents from within the interior, and that's what's needed. A quick point. Everyone seems to believe that mandatory E-Verify would solve the problem, and I'm here to tell you it will not. Not unless you have enough agents to do the field investigations and conduct the audits to make certain that unscrupulous employers don't hire off the books. This is labor-intensive work. We've only got about 3,000 ICE agents dedicated to enforcing immigration laws from within the interior of the United States. Contrast that number with 20,000 Border Patrol agents, 45,000 people at TSA, and the fact that New York City has 37,000 police officers. We need a massive hiring program so that we can truly and effectively and fairly enforce immigration laws from within the interior of the United States. And that would go a long way to solving so many of these issues that we're now confronting that have the potential to undermine national security and public safety.
Michael Cutler, we have to leave it at that for the moment. I commend to all of you A Broken Immigration System, Michael Cutler's brand new piece at Front Page Magazine. You've described some of the key elements, Michael, both in terms of the border and interior enforcement and going after these sleeper cells. We've got a lot of work cut out for us, and we appreciate your continuing service to our country. In addition to that, you rendered in the INS previously. Thank you for joining us. Come back to us again very soon. Next up, Lady Brigitte Gabriel joins us. We'll talk about jihad and Sharia blasphemy here in the United States right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. It is such fun to have with us a woman that I've come to admire tremendously for her courage, her leadership, her ability to communicate with the rest of us, some of her own life experiences and those that we all best be focusing on at a moment when they're likely to become ours as well. She is Lady Brigitte Gabriel. She is the founder of a marvelous organization, ACT for America. She has a fabulous experience arising from her time in Lebanon, where she was born as a Christian there, and her experiences in Israel and her life here in the United States, raising the alarm about what she experienced in her native land, namely Sharia supremacism, is the way I think of it. She's the author of two best-selling books, They Must Be Stopped, Why We Must Defeat Radical Islam and How We Can Do It. And the first book, I believe, Because They Hate, A Survivor of Islamic Terror Warns America. Brigitte Gabriel, thank you so much for being here, or m'lady, I guess I should say. Good to have you with us.
Oh, no. You can call me Brigitte, please.
Well, I'm so used to doing so. Brigitte, you have come in for a fair amount of grief, as frankly have I and our respective organizations, in connection with the recent effort, fortunately unsuccessful, to smear and undermine and block the nomination of Mike Pompeo to become our new Secretary of State. He is the new Secretary of State, thank goodness. But I'd like to just ask you about sort of what's going on with all of that. This group, the Southern Poverty Law Center, seems to have been a driving force behind it. Tell us about them and your experiences with them.
Well, the Southern Poverty Law Center considers itself God and considers itself the authority on who is supposedly a hater and who is not. What the SLC may have started with good intentions and started doing good work back in the 60s, but today they have become a war machine, shooting and trying to kill anyone that does not agree or conform to their radical, extreme leftist ideology. And they're not alone. They are working with organizations like the ADL,
the Anti-Defamation League.
Correct, the Anti-Defamation League and the ACLU. The SPLC is getting its talking points from CARE, the Council on American Islamic Relations. So you know where all that started. I mean, sometimes I read the SPLC write-ups about me, and it's literally verbatim the CARE press release or the CARE backgrounder.
So let's just explain all of this. When you say firing and trying to kill and all that, you mean that in the figurative sense, of course, I think. But there are people who have been using it, their information, for literally physical violence as well, notably against our friends at the Family Research Council. But Brigitte, this connection to several organizations, the Anti-Defamation League that was started to protect Jews against anti-Semitism, I think, and the Council on American Islamic Relations, a group that has been identified as a front for Hamas. I mean, these are unlikely sources of information about what we do, you and your organization, Act for America, and ours at the Center for Security Policy, to basically simply provide factual information about this totalitarian threat that you experienced firsthand in Lebanon called Sharia. What's up with that?
Exactly. And when you look at CARE, I mean, they are identified as labeled as a terrorist organization by the UAE. But that's the problem. Actually, when Cory Booker used in the hearing the question against me with Pompeo, asking Pompeo about his relationship with me, that was actually the letter sent by the ADL the day before to Cory Booker, giving him the questions. We got a letter, a copy of the letter the day before. And so we knew what the questions were going to be. And the letter was given by the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League.
Why would these guys be throwing in with Sharia supremacists who make no mistake about their desire to kill Jews? I mean, if there's anti-Semitism in the world today, I think you can't find it in a more concentrated and vicious form than in this Sharia program. Brigitte, again, you've experienced this firsthand in Lebanon. Why would the ADL, or for that matter, the Southern Poverty Law Center, be making common cause with haters, authentically haters of the CARE and other Sharia supremacist stripes?
Because the enemy of my enemy is my friend, at least for the time being, where I can use my enemy to advance my cause, thinking they're not going to hurt me now. And so in the SPLC, it generates a lot of money for them. I mean, look at the report just came out. I think they increased this year 35% their annual budget. They're now at 400 million plus. So for the SPLC, it translates money. for the ADL, it's basically the marriage of the leftists coming together at all costs to destroy their enemies. And that's why the ADL is working with CARE, because they believe CARE when CARE tells them, oh, we're together.
Hey, Brigitte, let me quickly turn to something else. You have, again, experienced firsthand people imposing on non-Muslim communities what amount to Sharia restrictions, whether it's, you know, the dimitude status or specifically Sharia blasphemy codes. Should we be worried when groups like Facebook and Google are now using the Southern Poverty Law Center and its partners, this red-green axis, to impose what certainly seemed to me to be increasingly the kind of censorship, the insurance that nobody gives offense to Muslims that Sharia blasphemy codes require?
Every conservative and every patriot who loves this country should be extremely concerned right now and should become involved immediately with organizations like yours and mine, Frank, with the Center for Security Policy or Act for America, in order to help us fight this fight. Because unless we come together as conservatives who are standing for the defense of free speech, you know, our founding fathers put that clause in our Constitution and our Bill of Rights and all of these, the foundation of America, for a reason. This is why we must come together and fight this. And I know that your group and my group and different groups are working with members of Congress. I know there are different organizations right now trying to put checks and balances against these organizations to make sure that they are being fair, because at this point, they are not.
Well, and have you at ACT experienced some of the effects of this sort of censorship, Brigitte?
Oh, my goodness. I mean, the day before yesterday, when Facebook supposedly had the glitch about, do you consider this a hate speech? We were the first people to get it out to the press, because, you know, we were one of the first people to receive it. They were asking people if they consider my post a hate speech. And all I was saying is, I'm a Lebanese immigrant to this country. I'm concerned about what's happening, blah, blah, blah. And that's when they asked, is this a hate speech? And that's when we got it out. And there has been many articles written about it. We've been, I was writing my book, Frank. I'm writing a new book, which will come out in September, titled Rise. And I was doing research. And there were articles that I wrote or were written about me that I wanted to quote or I wanted to use in my book. I could not even find them on the internet. And I searched and I looked, and they were my articles. I mean, I knew what's the content. There were articles about some of our chapter leaders, and I knew the content, and I knew the pictures in the articles. Those articles are no longer anywhere to be found. And so I experienced this personally, writing this book, thinking, wow, it was unbelievable.
This really, I think you put it yourself very well, Brigitte, and that is, this is warfare. This is political warfare. Let me ask you about one other thing, and we're going to be out of time before we run out of things to talk with you about, Brigitte, and I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. You have, again, had firsthand experience as a Lebanese Christian with persecution of your faith and its adherents. We talked the other day, as it happens in the margins of the White House, Brigitte, you and I, about the new Save the Persecuted Christians coalition that we're helping to call attention to this problem worldwide. I just wanted to invite you to talk a little bit about your own experiences and how grievous this problem is around the world.
It is globally now. You know, when I grew up, Frank, terrorism changed my life, because my 9/11 happened to me in 1975 when radical Islamists blew up my home, bringing it down, burying me under the rubble, wounded. I ended up in a bomb shelter for 7 years of my life trying to survive. And when I grew up and I became news anchor and I went to Israel and I worked as news anchor, and as I reported on world events, I started realizing that terrorist activities are happening around the world in the name of Islam. So what I used to think as a child growing up, that our problem was a regional problem between a majority Muslim Middle East trying to either kill or expel the minority Christians and Jews, is now a worldwide problem. But the world was not paying attention. So when you look at the world today, Christians, specifically Christians, because of the rise of Islam worldwide and the growing number of the Islamic population worldwide, Christians are persecuted anywhere around the world, in Indonesia, in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, in Egypt. Look what's happening to the Copts in Egypt. Look what's happening during the holidays to churches. You know, we can go to Easter, we just passed Easter, and celebrate and don't have to worry about a suicide bomber walking into our church and blowing us up on Easter morning. But when you look at Christian churches across the globe and in certain places like Egypt, what they have to do to protect themselves, that's, you know, that is just unacceptable. And the world needs to wake up, and especially Christians in America. If we Christians in America, where we are the most, the freest of people, where we live in the superpower of the world, if we do not bond together and come together to speak on behalf of the persecuted Christians, our brethren around the world, who else is going to do it? And I commend you for what you're doing.
Thank you, Brigitte. Well, we look forward to working with you in this, as in so many other areas. Lady Brigitte Gabrielle, the founder and president of a marvelous organization, Act for America. How can they find more information out about ACT?
People can go to our website, actforamerica.org, and join us, sign up to get our emails and action alert, become a member, become an activist.
Wonderful. Brigitte, thank you so much. I hope you'll come back to us again very soon. In the meantime, stay well and go forth and multiply, as they say. Next up, we'll speak with a former senior CIA spymaster, Brad Johnson, about the Gina Haspel nomination and more right after this.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. I am very pleased to say we have with us a man whose service to our country will almost certainly always be unsung, but nonetheless has been extraordinary and ongoing, really. He is no longer in the Directorate of Operations in the Central Intelligence Agency, where he served with great distinction for decades. He's now a private citizen and therefore free to speak his mind about some of the important matters involving, well, threats to our country and its vital security interests. His name is Bradley Johnson. He has taken up most recently the cause of ensuring that the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency is the kind of person who will bring to the Central Intelligence Agency the qualities of leadership and robustness that these times require. He is the author of a piece in the Washington Times about a week or so ago entitled "Fixing a Weakened Espionage Brand," which is a pretty important critique of Gina Haspel, the person that President Trump has nominated to be the next director of the Central Intelligence Agency. Bradley Johnson, thank you so much for joining us. It's great to have you with us.
Frank, thank you so much for having me again. It's always a pleasure to speak with you and Secure Freedom Radio.
Good. It's our pleasure. Listen, you have served in a number of very senior and sensitive positions in the agency over the years, including as the chief of station, the top CIA officer in a variety of countries. Gina Haspel has done so as well. I wonder whether you have crossed paths professionally with her or whatever light you can shed on her story, because until very recently, it was all a state secret.
Correct. Gene and I do not know each other personally, although, of course, we've crossed paths many times through the years. We started in the agency in a similar period, and after I retired, she stayed on and is, of course, still there, as everyone is aware. While I don't know her personally, and I am very happy with the concept of the CIA director being an inside career professional to run the agency. I think that's a fabulous idea. And of course, it's something that's used when the director of the FBI is selected or somebody at DOJ. I mean, they pick basically inside professionals who can run an organization of that sort. So I do agree with that part of the selection. However, under the former director Brennan and under the previous Obama administration, what had happened was the operational capability of the CIA and the operations is where recruitments are done, where espionage takes place. That was formerly a highly trained cadre of people that knew their stuff, which is where I came from and which is where Gina came from. And those were the hard-won lessons passed down from OSS days in World War II all the way through to the present. And that was just dismantled under the Obama administration and former Director Brennan, which he called his modernization plan. Now, with Gina Haspel, what worries me with Gina is that she's run the day-to-day elements of the agency for more than a year, and she's done absolutely nothing to turn that around. Just saying that, yeah, we're trying to get back to basics, and yet without reinstating an operations branch of or divisions within the CIA, how can you possibly make that claim? That training takes years to quickly play all through and so on.
The rap on her has been to this point that she was involved in the extraordinary rendition programs and the waterboarding of some detainees at the critical early days after 9/11, where we were desperately trying to extract information about what other attacks might be in the works. You've really raised another set of issues altogether. Before I get to that, let me just ask you about the other. Do you have particular concerns about what she did in connection with rendition and interrogation?
Well, I personally have none whatsoever. I mean, I do respect the opinion of, say, for example, Senator Rand Paul, who objects to those things. I understand his position and respect it, but I personally do not have objections to that. And let's face it, after 9/11, we didn't know. We needed to get a handle on what was going on. And for all we knew, there were another 10 or 15 or 20 operations just like 9/11 that were in the pipeline and were going to be taking place shortly. And we had to step in and do something. And that was all part of that program. Well, after a number of years had gone by, we did get a handle on it. And that's when you saw the importance of rendition programs and the enhanced interrogation and so on lose relative importance. So I have no objections to that personally and was very proud of my contributions in the counterterrorism field while I was active with the agency. So I have no problems with that whatsoever. I personally don't think it's fair that Gina Haspel be criticized on those particular issues. She did what she was ordered to do. She wasn't the person setting policy for the United States government. She was the person carrying out U.S. government policies.
And with respect to the issue of destroying some of the tapes that, or all of the tapes, I guess, that contained information and videos of the waterboarding process?
Well, I believe that decision was actually made by Jose Rodriguez, who was chief of the counterterrorist division at the time. And of course, Gina worked closely with him and so on. But I believe the decision was his at the time, which I would have to say that I have no doubt that Jose, who I do know, probably looks back at that as one of the best decisions he's ever made in his life, because he recognized that no matter what happens, at some point in the future, they're going to drag all that stuff out and use it against him for political motives.
And others, presumably, too. Let me turn to this other critique. And again, you've been in the field. You have been responsible for recruiting and running spies. You have deep knowledge of both the requirements of that tradecraft and the limitations of it. What has been done in the name of modernization of our clandestine services or our espionage, our HUMINT, as it's called, human intelligence capabilities, that you find so troubling? And as best you can tell, what was Gina Haspel's role in all of that, quite apart from not undoing it, you know, during the past 15 months or so?
The central objection on my part is that, you know, this is a highly trained cadre of people that run operations and do clandestine recruitment of reporting sources overseas. In other words, espionage. It's not easy. Very few people do it well. It's something a very small, even among the highly trained, it's a small group of people who just naturally do it well. And that has to be nurtured and take advantage of all the lessons learned, as I mentioned previously, all the way from World War II OSSS or OSS through today. And just under former Director Brennan, that was not valued. Now, he comes from a leftist philosophy, and, you know, as famously known, voted for a communist candidate for president and so on. So philosophically, he was against the concept of espionage and played that out and dismantled it under the guise of modernization and bringing in more robust technical collection, which that is good. But getting rid of the human, which is the reason for being for a CIA, it just makes no sense whatsoever. Now, since then, the training has been broken down into little things. And of course, who's down doing the training now? It's all the guys like myself who've been retired for a few years and go down and do that. And their capabilities and training and everything is slowly being lost because it's not used anymore. There's been a lot of public criticism of this, saying it's one size fits all. And I reiterate that as well. It is one size fits all when you've got analysts and support and everybody all getting the same training. It's not specialized. You're not developing that cadre. So you're not taking advantage of the people that are in place that still have those capabilities, like Gina. She came from that background. And you're not passing that on to the younger people coming up. Instead, they've turned to rely on the liaison relationships with other countries. Now, again, that's an important aspect of it. It needs to be included as well, but not at the expense of running our own unilateral U.S.-only operations. And that's the danger.
But let me ask you about that. What exactly is the problem with relying on liaison services? These are presumably friendly governments that are helping us understand something that they're obviously dealing with themselves. Is it not the case that the quality of their intelligence in their own countries might be considerably better than ours? And why would a John Brennan, for example, not say, well, you know, that's a sensible way to divide the labors and we'll benefit from it?
Well, as I say, it is a valuable portion of gathering intelligence. Our liaison relationships with other countries' intelligence services is fundamentally important. I don't disagree on that basis. But there are certain inherent problems with having that be your only source, for example, or depending overly much on liaison.
Because they might deceive you or give you information that is serving their interests but not necessarily factually correct or serving ours, needless to say.
Yeah.
Have you seen some sign of that in the past in your experience in the field? Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Liaison is going to do just what we do. I mean, they act in their own self-interest, and our self-interests often overlap, but they often do not overlap, and their interests might diverge from ours. So they then, knowing where we get our information, can influence it.
Yeah, I'm assuming that in cases where you're interested in knowing what's actually going on in that country, if it's not to the benefit of the government to have you know that, they may actually be spoon-feeding you something very different indeed. Brad, we are out of time. I just wanted to say I personally take no comfort from the fact that Gina Haspel has been endorsed by the likes of John Brennan and Michael Morell and Jim Clapper and Michael Hayden and Condoleezza Rice, for that matter. I mean, these are people whose judgment about these things, among other things, I have found to be deeply problematic over the years. And so, while I respect Mike Pompeo enormously and I'm thrilled that he is the Secretary of State, I think I align with you on the desirability of having somebody who has many of the most important qualities of Gina Haspel, but not some of the baggage, especially with respect to her service with John Brennan in dismantling our human intelligence capabilities. Thank you so much for joining us today, sir, and for the extraordinary service you've rendered to our country over such a long time. Next up, we'll speak with David Goldman. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for what is, I'm pleased to say, more or less a weekly visit now with David Goldman, one of the smartest guys I know about most things, but particularly about the nexus between the economic affairs of the world, and particularly those affecting our country, and our, well, broader just geostrategic interests. He is the author of numerous essays under the pseudonym Spengler in Asia Times. He is also the managing director of Reorient Group Limited. He is a fabulous resource, and we're always delighted to have a chance to pick his brains. David, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Oh, Frank, thank you for so many kind words. Always a pleasure.
Heartfelt and deserved in this case. Let me ask you about one of the things that's been happening over the past 2 days in your beat in China. American senior economic officials have been meeting with their Chinese counterparts. The meeting has just broken up, as I understand it, as we speak, David Goldman. What do we know about what, if anything, came of it all?
We know there was no agreement. The United States asked the Chinese to reduce the trade deficit by $200 billion within the next 2 years and to stop subsidizing a lot of their high-tech industries that are included in their Made in China 2025 program. The Chinese said we simply can't do that, and we're left essentially with nothing. Not clear how what the United States does next. The basic problem, Frank, is the world economy has been based on a global supply chain optimized for efficiency and low cost, and that's propelled tech companies to very high valuations and generated huge amounts of revenue. If the Chinese respond to our refusal to sell computer chips to ZTE, China's number two telecom company, by developing their own, the United States responds by similar protectionist measures, that supply chain gets broken, it becomes much more expensive, and the profit base of the world economy will dwindle. And that's very bad for stocks. That's what the stock market is now worried about, rightly so.
Hmm. Is it from that other part of your brain that I value so much, the geostrategic perspective, necessary for us to break that supply chain, specifically our dependency upon China for a whole host of high technology items essential to our economy, as well as increasingly, it seems, our security?
I think the key issue here is innovation. If we simply raise the cost of producing all of the existing stuff we're using now, we're going to get stagflation, much lower growth, perhaps a recession, higher prices, and a very unpleasant economy. The Chinese will tighten their belts if they have to, and we may see the world supply chain split into two protected parts, a Chinese sphere and an American sphere. And I wouldn't trust the Europeans, the Japanese, or the Koreans not to shift over to the Chinese sphere. I don't think we can count on our former friends and allies in that kind of thing.
What could you just explain, what does that mean, practically speaking, shifting over? Does that mean that they essentially stop trading with us, or simply that they are more dependent upon the Chinese?
Well, the Chinese say the United States wants protectionism, we want free trade. Europe, let's do a free trade deal. So they're already anticipating that. Volkswagen, for example, just announced an $18 billion investment in China for electric cars. They're the biggest car producer in China, by the way, and they have the world's most efficient automobile assembly plants in China. So we would see a reorientation of investment and trade towards China and more economic isolation of the United States. It wouldn't be dramatic, but it would shrink our capacity to grow and our strategic power.
And perhaps have impact on alliances as well, would you say?
Oh, absolutely. The alliance with Korea is now in play. The president has been talking about reducing the number of American troops in South Korea. That worries me because I don't trust the Norks for a second. I think their objective has always been to conquer South Korea, and I don't think they've given that up. But to the extent that South Korea sees the United States eager to wash its hands of responsibility for Asia, they'll have to make a deal with China. China will be the guarantor of their security, if any there be. The Japanese will also make a deal with China because they won't count on the United States to protect them. To the extent the economic ties point in the same direction, we could have a vast growth of Chinese strategic and economic power at the expense of the United States. That's a risk.
But innovation, as you fondly put it to me repeatedly, is perhaps our whole card in these matters. Do you see at the present time, David Goldman, the environment in which that innovation is likely to be forthcoming? Have the tax cuts and all of the economic benefits that are flowing from them translated into an environment in which not only is money being repatriated to the United States, but, you know, investment in the kinds of seed corn that we need to out-innovate the Chinese can, you know, prosper?
You have a lot of investment going into things like the oil patch, which is well and good. However, the kind of innovation at the frontiers of physics, which, for example, would transform semiconductor production, is not happening here. I see virtually no venture capital going into hard physics. Everything's going into software. The 130th dating app gets pitched to the venture capitalists, but not something that would, for example, turn to scrap the whole Chinese investment in semiconductor production. If you've got a power that will spend infinite amounts of money building up existing industries, subsidizing capital investment, they have a gigantic weakness. They're betting massively on existing technologies. If you come up with something better, then you turn that whole investment into junk. That's how we broke the Soviet Union in the 1980s. But I don't see that happening, and I worry that the president has not yet even appointed a head of the White House Office of Science and Technology. There's nobody responsible for that kind of program in the administration. That's the kind of thing Reagan did. It's the Kennedy moonshot approach. We've done it before, but we don't seem to be doing it now.
We've talked about this from time to time, about sort of it's not quite an industrial policy, but it's an impetus for industrial-oriented investment and innovation, as you say. We'll be following this closely with your good help, David Goldman. Let me turn to one other thing that you've addressed this week, and that was Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's stunning press conference in which he disclosed that Israel had managed to, well, steal half a ton of secret documents about the Iranian nuclear weapons program. What did you make of the revelations by Benjamin Netanyahu, and what do you think comes next, David?
There's no doubt on the basis of Netanyahu's revelations that Iran is gearing up for war, nuclear weapons, ballistic missiles, and so forth. It's been a continuous regime commitment. The issue of whether they've technically violated the Iran nuclear deal is irrelevant because, as the Israelis have said, they're geared up to enrich uranium and have the missiles ready to deliver bombs the moment the deal expires in a few years. So those objections are irrelevant. Iran is an imperialist expansionist power. It's responsible for massive ethnic cleansing in Syria, pushing out Sunnis, bringing in its own Shiite settlers and creating missile bases and other bases in Syria so that it can attack Israel. Israel will not stand for that. That's an existential threat to its existence. So one thing that can happen is that there is an Israeli-Iranian war, which would be devastating. The oil price would go up to $200 a barrel. We'd have a recession. We wouldn't like it. Another thing is that the United States sits down with Russia, which is Iran's sponsor and provider of military technology, and says, you really don't want this to happen. And we work out some deal with Russia and China to put the Iranians on a leash and prevent them from preparing for war technologically and creating the basis for war in Syria. I don't see a third alternative. Mm.
Well, I fear the third alternative, which is kind of implied in what you've already said, though, is there is a war, and it's not confined to the Middle East. It spreads far beyond. A very chilling prospect indeed. David Goldman, your insights into all of these matters are extraordinarily important, and we appreciate you sharing them with us week on, week out. We look forward to doing so with you next week. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again on Monday. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.